dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Tune to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, and WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last weekend, we traveled to Quebec City to cover the protests surrounding the Summit of the Americas, a meeting of 34 heads of state from the Western Hemisphere gathered to negotiate the so-called Free Trade Area of the Americas, which will expand and intensify the provisions of NAFTA, as well as extend them to the entire hemisphere. The purpose of the FTAA is to commodify every aspect of existence and allow a corporation to make a profit thereby, at the expense of everyone else. The primary beneficiaries are the owners of U.S.-based multinationals and their counterparts in other countries. The real story of the summit was the state repression against protest and dissent, in advance of, during, and it appears, beyond. Since the 1994 Zapatista uprising in Mexico against the North American Free Trade Agreement, a worldwide movement against neoliberal economics and the rule of capital has been growing, meeting with increasing repression. Democracy is being shown to be a hollow concept, immediately sacrificed when the popular interest conflicts with the desires of the rich and powerful. In the first hour of our program, we'll take you with us on our journey across the border into Canada and into the tear gas-filled streets of Quebec City, and then to a press conference on a U.S. government attempt to seize the server logs of the Seattle Independent Media Center to gain access to the identities of indie media contributors. In the second hour, an interview with an anarchist community organizer from Quebec, who talks about the experiences and feelings of many of the people in the Quebec neighborhoods impacted by the summit and the protests.
They take it by stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black.
The first issue confronting American travelers to the summit was crossing the Canadian border. The Canadian government had previously announced its intention to keep out as many American protesters as possible, and even before the summit, people who'd been arrested at previous anti-capitalist protests were denied entry, as well as those with political literature or other emblems of dissent. A variety of protest activities were planned for various points of entry. We chose to go via the Mohawk Nation of Akwesasne, where a contingent from the community had called for a day of rage in opposition to the FTAA and in support of Mohawk sovereignty. Akwesasne is a poor community. In Akwesasne, the U.S.-Canadian border has cut their community in half, causing Mohawks to have to routinely undergo searches, questions, and official harassment from both governments merely to visit family and friends in the part of the community on the other side of the line. Originally, some Mohawks in coalition with anti-poverty groups on the Canadian side had vowed to open the border for the activists, but this plan was prevented by Mohawk officialdom and others in the community who feared armed conflict would result. The tribal government, with close ties to U.S. officialdom, began a campaign of fear against the activists. In the end, activists were invited to a fish fry at the foot of the bridge. A peaceful march across the bridge was planned, with a similar contingent approaching from the other side. At the fish fry, we spoke with John Boots, one of the event's organizers from Akwesasne. He told us that the Mohawks had been inspired by the Zapatista uprising in Mexico, but this was the first time Akwesasne had addressed the issues directly. For the Mohawks, pollution and poverty were the fruits of corporate globalization. The St. Lawrence River has traditionally been a source of water, food, and recreation for the people of Akwesasne. But several multinational corporations, including General Motors, Alcoa Aluminum, and a paper mill, have built factories that dump toxic waste into the river. They have poisoned the water supply of Akwesasne and added insult to injury by hiring few of the residents.
There are aluminum plants just west of here, and of course the Robert Moses powerhouse. That has been very detrimental to the river and thus to the people of Akwesasne. But like I said, pertaining to the paper mill, we get the pollution into the river and the pollution in the air. And like I said, we do not invest in stocks for either Alcoa or General Motors because we can't. We're economically unable to. And so all we get is the pollution from the industrialization.
And they're not actually then technically on your land, so you can't control their behavior.
That's right. But they have the elective councils has an environmental department, and they are trying with testing machines. And there was one lawsuit back in the 70s, and that was settled. The aluminum company was made to pay almost $700,000. But
of course, what is that in response for, you know, in taking people's lives and poisoning the land?
Right.
What is $700,000?
That's right. It's not very much.
Yeah.
And I like to tell the story that I'm only 60 years old, and when I was in my teens, we used to do a lot of our recreation and play in the river, and we used to drink out of the river, and that's how nice it was. In addition to that, there were nice beaches, sandy beaches, on the approach of this particular bridge. They destroyed that beach to build the abutments for the bridge. So we have no more shorelines to swim at, and we can't drink the river. We can't drink the water. And that's in the span of 40-some years.
That was John Boots of Akwesasne, one of the organizers of the April 19th border crossing. After the meal and a round of speeches, about 500 people marched across the bridge to the island separating the U.S. and Canada, where the customs booths were located. Sean Brand, a Mohawk from the Canadian side who's active with the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, spoke to the marchers and spectators from Akwesasne, who had gathered to watch.
Okay, I want to say a few things. At first, I want all people, the cops that are here, the RCMP, the OPP, and most importantly, the people of Akwesasne need to understand, first and foremost, what's going on. There's the delegation from the United States, which is going to Quebec City in order to combat governments that are engaging in policies and practices that's going to further erode, cause suffering, and entrench further poverty in our communities. Now I want our young people that are present to hear this. You've been told that people who are coming are riotous, that they were going to burn your homes, that they were going to destroy your businesses. And that is not the case. These people are here on our behalf. They're going to Quebec City, and they're going to fight the same goddamn government that we fight every single day when we live here in Akwesasne and other First Nations communities in Canada. I want these people to understand and know what's going on in Akwesasne. We came from the GM plant that's accused of having 10 million gallons of PCBs in three lagoons that has poisoned this community, that has made it so that our women cannot breastfeed their children, that has made it so that our children are born with defects, stillbirths, and miscarriages. This is something that the people of Akwesasne face each and every day when they live in this hellhole. Now, this place, customs, is a further affront, not just to the sovereignty of Mohawk people, but it is an affront to the human dignity and the decency of people that live in this community. When you have to tolerate environmental attacks, attacks and destruction in this community, and then every single day you have to turn around and report to these people, tell them where you're going, tell them where you've been, open your trunk, subject yourself to seizures. These are the things that's happened in this place here. I heard when I first came into Akwesasne a month or so ago of a woman who we were denied the opportunity to ever know or ever experience her child, because they were the ones who were responsible. They were the ones who engaged in an action that caused her to lose her baby. These people are people who are responsible for beatings of people in Akwesasne, for harassment, for attacks, for assaults, and these are the types of things that we're addressing today. People have to understand that the stories I've heard of people going to Quebec City, they're saying they were detained at customs for an hour. They had their stuff searched. They had their papers searched. Well, goddammit, that happens every single day to the people of Akwesasne. And if life isn't harsh enough, these people park their asses right in the middle of our community, and they are an affront to the sovereignty of Mohawk people. They are an affront to the dignity of people within this community. Now, my friends and the people in Akwesasne who organized this, and we made a pledge. We made a pledge to show these young people over here that there is other options to raising issues of dissent than picking up a gun and blowing somebody's head off. There are ways where people can come together through the race, Native, non-Native, Mohawk, Ojibwe, all those people who can come together and express not only their dissent, but their contempt for governments that allow this to happen, and their contempt for governments that allow it to continue. We know the story of free trade. Free trade allows a company like GM. It allows for environmental protection laws to be thrown out the window. It doesn't just tolerate what's going on in the GM plant and the other plants around Akwesasne. Free trade doesn't just allow it, it legalizes it. We stand, the Mohawks of Akwesasne, Kanyungehaga of the nation, we stand to say that we have experienced the shit from NAFTA. Three countries. We know what trade agreements do. We experience it every single day. And now they want to add 31 more countries. 31 more countries of indigenous people that they can dump their shit beside their communities, contaminate their water, destroy their hunting and fishing, destroy their ways of life. And the people of Akwesasne and Kanyungehaga say, no more. We send the message out to people all across this hemisphere that you do not have to tolerate this, that people must organize in such a way that these governments that step forward on this agenda are governments that are not only going to be protested, these are governments that the people are going to organize, and we will defeat those governments.
A peaceful, proper type of protest.
I'm not even going to say whether I agree with that or not, but I can tell you one thing, that for the people of Akwesasne, there has been a sufficient degree of suffering and something that must be acknowledged. And certainly, if we are the people we are and the honor that we carry and our commitment to proceed against these governments, then we also have a responsibility in honoring our young people of Akwesasne, but not just for simple peaceful dissent, but to say that we stand with them, we will provide them with a future, we will provide them with clean drinking water, and we will not allow governments to dump their shit and poison our waters, poison our communities, and contaminate our people. Not now. April 19th is the day it stops. April 20th is the day that we start taking our nations back, our countries back, and our societies back.
John Brand, Mohawk and anti-poverty activist. Once at customs, activists were on their own. Meanwhile, the Canadian group, which had traveled from Toronto and Kingston to meet the crossing Americans, was blocked from approaching the border by Canadian police decked out in full riot gear. After a four-hour delay, two searches of our belongings, and interviews with Canadian immigration, we were on our way. Not everyone was as lucky. Many of the Americans turned back when their friends were denied entry. On the other side, some of the Canadians in the caravan had waited for the crossing Americans to offer them a hot meal and moral support. In all, the whole experience made clear how ineffective a peaceful march was against armed police. Those with the guns decided how it was going to go, as usual, onto the streets of Quebec City, April 20th.
Turn to your right for the Carnival Against Capitalism,
called by Conscious Canada. Welcome. We're standing at the Laval University, where there's a mustering for the first day's march. This is a legal march described as a yellow action, peaceful with some civil disobedience. There's a wide variety of people, many banners, brightly colored banners and flags. Hi, my name is Lynn, and this is Sean.
Hi, I'm Scooter.
Hi, Scooter. So, what is the significance of the police shirts and the pink tutus?
And the whoopee cushions. it's a bit of a, I guess you could call it a real jam of messages. Well, for one thing, we're trying to show just how ridiculous the militarization, the level of militarization that's been going on here really is. The fact that protesters are portrayed as demonized, as portrayed as threats, armed threats, and the escalation on the part of the state and the groups that are organizing this event, the Summit of the Americas, how they target us and basically vilify us. So we're trying to mess with their heads on that level, just to show how ridiculous it is. And I guess on a lighter note, we're hoping the cops will be too busy trying to figure out what the hell we actually signify to go around and bust heads.
Are you all from the same place?
Yeah, we're here with our local, actually.
Union local?
Yeah.
Which union?
Yeah, QP 3903. We represent, we're contract faculty, teaching assistants, and graduate assistants at York University in Toronto.
Great.
And we're here on the heels of a successful 3-month-long strike. So we're carrying it on, I guess you could say.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
What have you noticed in terms of changes in Canadian society since NAFTA came in?
Jobs. I graduated from my undergrad in 94 and was broke for quite a long time, to put it mildly. And even during the so-called upswing in the mid to late 90s, so you could find a job that paid you maybe $15,000 a year or something. At the same time, I know in Ontario, when the current government came into power, I guess it was 1995.
This is the Mike Harris.
Mike Harris,
yes.
Progressive Conservative government. There was a lot of reaction to it, but at the same time, they won a second term. So there's a split in that sense. I know I was pretty disheartened. So It's great to see a sort of more of an upsurge now in these sorts in sort of resistance to that, and organizing levels and a diversity of tactics and the ability to, you know, make it a lot more, I hate to say it, but a lot more fun, a lot more encouraging, and a lot more in your face at the same time. In a sense, we still continue, like, I'm talking about mainstream Canadian society. I think there's that impression that we're very tolerant because we allow Pride Day or we allow peaceful demonstrations, but we turn the other way when it does come to policing, and the police budgets are going up. The laws are getting much harsher at a municipal level, if not at a provincial and federal level, and even when the laws aren't there, I mean, like, the police have shown that they're quite willing to take matters into their own hands and work totally against the law.
So can you give me some examples of that come to mind recently?
Well, in Ontario, there is an organization that's been very involved and militant in fighting, particularly the Harris government, and their members have been targeted for police action in terms of arrest,
is
detention.
Is that OCAP?
Yeah, they've been subject to a lot of surveillance and a lot of harassment. And people, not that organization, but I know people who are familiar and may have alliances with maybe them or other organizations around anti-racist work, or actually people involved in legal aid clinics have been targeted for police surveillance, if not worse. So the cops have lists, and they make the rounds, and they make sure that people sometimes know that they're under surveillance. And so there's just that too, that whole chill factor.
The gap between the rich and poor is growing, it grows. We've got less and they got more, it shows. Workers are being shown the door. Never forget what you're fighting for, and we all go marching down.
There's a circle forming of people dancing to the drum beats that you hear. Right in the center of René Lévesque, in front of the museum.
It appears the protesters have successfully backed down the police for the time being. Oh, well, that's changing right now. It's still a tense situation here. Again, at the corner of Rue de la René Lévesque and Rue de la l'Amérique Française, we're literally about 20 feet from the barricade. Protesters have managed to take down the fence. They've managed to, there's a confrontational situation at the wall, and tear gas or nothing is, nothing. No discernible response from the police has happened, although there are plumes of smoke to the... Are they firing tear gas? Is that tear gas? It looks like tear gas is being fired. The police may charge at any minute. They're firing tear gas to my right at the moment. Protesters are throwing the tear gas back. They're firing tear gas in the front at the moment as well.
The blue guys have dark navy suits on. They have batons, just like the green guys. There's probably women too. And they seem to have a lot more tear gas. They seem to shoot more tear gas, and they have police dogs too.
Yeah.
This from the April 21st, 2001 issue of the Toronto Globe and Mail. How to Nab an Activist: Even the Green Zone Wasn't a Safe Haven, by Naomi Klein. Where are you? I screamed from my cell phone into his. There was a pause, and then a green zone, St. Jean and St. Clair. Green zone is protest speak for an area free of tear gas or police clashes. There are no fences to storm, only sanctioned marches. Green zones are safe. You're supposed to be able to bring your kids to them. Okay, I said. See you in 15 minutes. I had barely put on my coat when I got another call. Jaggy's been arrested. Well, not exactly arrested, more like kidnapped. My first thought was that it was my fault. I had asked Mr. Singh to tell me his whereabouts over a cell phone. Our call must have been monitored. That's how they found him. If that sounds paranoid, welcome to Summit City. Less than an hour later, at the Comité Populaire Saint-Jean-Baptiste Community Center, a group of six swollen-eyed eyewitnesses read me their handwritten accounts of how the most visible organizer of yesterday's direct action protest against the free trade area of the Americas was snatched from under their noses. I'll say Mr. Singh was standing around talking to friends, urging them to move further away from the breach security fence. They all say he was trying to de-escalate the police standoff. He said it was getting too tense, said Mike Stodenmeyer, a U.S. activist who was talking to Mr. Singh when he was grabbed from behind and surrounded by three large men. They were dressed like activists, said Helen Nazon, a 23-year-old from Quebec City, with hooded sweatshirts, bandanas on their faces, flannel shirts, a little grubby. They pushed Jaggy on the ground and kicked him. It was really violent. Then they dragged him off, said Michelle Lulin. All the witnesses told me that when Mr. Singh's friends closed in to try to rescue him, the men dressed as activists pulled out long batons, beat back the crowd, and identified themselves. Police, they shouted. Then they threw him into a beige van and drove off. Several of the young activists have opened cuts where they were hit. 3 hours after Mr. Singh's arrest, there was still no word of where he was being held. Throwing activists into unmarked cars and nabbing them off the streets is not supposed to happen in Canada. The strange thing is that, in Jaggy Singh's short career as an anti-globalization activist, it has happened to him before, during the 1997 protests against the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. The day before the protests took place, Mr. Singh was grabbed by two plainclothes officers while walking alone on the University of British Columbia campus, thrown to the ground and stuffed into an unmarked car. The charge, he later found, was assault. Mr. Singh had apparently talked so loudly into a megaphone some weeks before that it had hurt the eardrum of a nearby police officer. The charge, of course, was later dropped, but the point was clearly to have Mr. Singh behind bars during the protest, just as he will no doubt be in custody for today's march. He faced a similar arrest at the G20 summit in Montreal. In all of these bizarre cases, Jaggy Singh has never been accused of vandalism or of planning or plotting violent actions. Anyone who has seen him at the barricades, crumbling or otherwise, knows that his greatest crime is giving good speeches. That's why I was on the phone with Mr. Singh minutes before his arrest, trying to persuade him to come to the People Summit teach-in that I was co-hosting to tell the crowd of 1,500 what was going on in the streets. He had agreed, but then determined it was too difficult to cross the city. I can't help thinking the fact that this young man has been treated as a terrorist repeatedly with no evidence might have something to do with his brown skin and the fact that his last name is Singh. No wonder his friends say that this supposed threat to the state doesn't like to walk alone at night. After collecting all the witness statements, the small crowd begins to leave the community center to attend a late-night planning meeting. In an instant, the halls are filled with red-faced people, their eyes streaming with tears, frantically looking for running water. The tear gas has filled the street outside the center and has entered the corridors. There is no longer a green zone. So much for making it to my laptop at the hotel. Dennis Bellinger, who was kind enough to let me use the community center's rickety PC to write this column, notices that the message light is flashing on the phone. It turns out that the police have enclosed the entire area. No one is getting out. Maybe I'll spend the night, Mr. Bellinger says. Maybe I will too. And that was from Naomi Klein. Even the Green Zone wasn't a safe haven. Published in the Saturday, April 21st, 2001 edition of the Toronto Globe and Mail.
An update on the status of Jaggy Singh, who folks from Ithaca and Syracuse may remember as one of the speakers with the FTAA caravan that came through the area last month. Jaggy was denied bail at his hearing on Wednesday and remains in jail as of Friday, April 27th. Protesters as far away as Prague, Czechoslovakia, have demanded his release. In addition to Jaggy, it is estimated that about 450 people were arrested over the weekend in Quebec City. Some people have simply disappeared, and it's unclear whether they've been arrested or are simply lying low. At the end of the program, we'll give information as to how you can contribute to the legal funds, the costs of which are rising by the day.
I am at the top of, or near the top of, Côte d'Abraham, Quebec City. It's the second day of the demonstrations. This is Saturday, and as expected, there's nearly 40,000 people here, and from what we've seen, it certainly looks like it could be 40,000 or more. There's a freeway to the right of me. I'm facing a church, Saint-Vincent de Paul, and there are people occupying the highway and clanging on the guardrails. We're at the wall, one of the locations at the wall around the old city where the FTAA meeting is, Free Trade Area of America's meeting is occurring, and there's heavy tear gas. It seems to die down a little bit, but people are waiting until their numbers are strong enough to approach the wall more confidently.
Another volley of tear gas fire. Walk!
There's another volley of tear gas being fired. Protesters are kicking it back. You want to go? You can go ahead and help me out. Catch up. People are moving away. The black block is grabbing the tear gas canisters and throwing them back. People will, once the scene clears, I'm sure people will return. This is basically how it's been going for the past half hour or so here.
Since the WTO protests in Seattle in 1999, officials, media, and even some protesters have condemned militant demonstrators who've taken on the police and the property of capitalist institutions. The increasing police presence and security measures have been justified as necessary due to the presence of these protesters. The security measures and police brutality in Quebec City have created some surprising critics, including a former conservative pro-FTAA member of parliament.
A police state in the making, democracy trampled in Quebec City by Sinclair Stevens. I never thought I'd be writing this article, surely not in Canada, but there aren't many people in this country who view free trade as positively as I do. As industry minister in the Mulroney government, I participated in the 1985 Shamrock Summit that set the stage for our trade agreement with the United States. I was even responsible for replacing the Foreign Investment Review Agency with Investment Canada, a welcome mat for our partners to the south. There also aren't many people who view the maintenance of law and order as a higher priority than I do. But this past weekend, I was shocked by events in Quebec City, shocked by what I saw, and stunned by what my wife Noreen and I personally experienced. I believe Canada is right to view free trade as a model for democratic development in every corner of our hemisphere. And I was delighted to see us host the Summit of the Americas. But our government is dead wrong to behave in a manner that suggests we have forgotten what democracy is all about. Noreen and I arrived in Quebec City last Friday at about 5 p.m. We had heard about the so-called security fence and wanted to see it firsthand, to walk along beside it. My first view of the fence was in front of the Chateau Frontenac. It brought back memories of many happy visits to that hotel. But this weekend I could not enter. The hotel was inside the fence. I was outside. As we walked around the perimeter, a 40-year-old chap passed us and asked, "Where's your gas mask?" I asked what he meant. He said, "There is gas farther on. Watch out." We continued until we saw our first contingent of riot-geared police lined up three deep behind a closed gate. They were an intimidating sight, in battle dress with helmets, masks, shields, and assorted elaborate weapons. I was glad, this time, that they were inside the fence and we were outside. Farther on, just before we got to Dufferin Street, there were perhaps 50 people, protesters it turned out, who were standing or sitting on a small side road. At the end of the road, we saw a much larger group of riot police standing shoulder to shoulder several rows deep. The road was well away from the security fence. In fact, the fence was nowhere in sight. I spoke with many of the people in the street, asked them what they had gathered, why they opposed the free trade proposals. It was a lively but friendly exchange. We were interrupted as the police down the road began an eerie drumming, rattling their riot sticks against their shields. Slowly, in unison, 1 6-inch step at a time, they began marching toward us. Noreen and I moved to the side of the street as the protesters remained stationary. Some formed V signs with their fingers. To my horror, the police then fired tear gas canisters directly at those sitting or standing on the road. As clouds of gas began to spread, Noreen and I felt our eyes sting and our throats bake. We pulled whatever clothing we could across our mouths. One young woman who had been among the protesters offered us some vinegar. "What's that for?" I asked. "It takes away the sting," she said, and it did help. The police, however, kept advancing. One large policeman with the number 5905 on his helmet pressed right against me and ordered me to get behind a railing. "I haven't done anything," I protested. "Why?" He simply replied, "Get behind the rail." Then he added, "And get down." I did so. I shook my head. I never thought I would ever see this kind of police state tactic in Canada. What we witnessed that night was mild compared to events the next afternoon. This time, we walked along the fence until we reached the gate at René Lévesque Boulevard, where a great crowd had gathered that included TV cameras and reporters. I was asked for an interview by a CBC crew, but before we could begin, dozens of tear gas canisters were fired, water cannons were sprayed, and rubber bullets began to hit people nearby. Three times I felt I could not breathe, my eyes were sore, and all I could do was run. In the bedlam, my wife and I were separated for almost 3 hours. She said she had almost passed out from the gassing. We lost something else, besides each other, last weekend in Quebec, our innocence. This government and some reporters like to brand the Quebec City demonstrators as, quote, hooligans, unquote. That is not fair. I talked to dozens of them, mostly university students, aged about 20. They came to Quebec not to have, quote, a good time, unquote, as some suggest, but to express their well-thought-out views on a subject that is important to them, to all of us. I may not have agreed with their position, but I sure believe in their right to express it. The police had no cause to violently suppress it. Some will say that a handful of demonstrators got out of hand and forced the police to take collective action. I can't agree. The police action in Quebec City, under orders from our government, was a provocation itself, an assault on all our freedoms. Sinclair Stevens, Minister of Regional Industrial Expansion under Brian Mulroney, was a member of parliament from 1972 to 1988. This article appeared in the April 24th, 2001 issue of the Toronto Globe and Mail. A police state in the making. Democracy trampled in Quebec City.
Recently wherein he was trying to get the court to order the fence and the passes were illegal and hence should be brought down. The court held that there was a serious breach of the fundamental rights of Canadian citizens, but because of the seriousness of the fact that the summit was happening here and that there were protesters in other jurisdictions who had caused some kind of trouble, that therefore it was justified to keep the fence up and to keep the passes viable. That those justifications are, in our view, illegal in law, and we filed on Friday, the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee and myself personally, are carrying on with the lawsuit and are appealing to this. We're going before the Supreme Court of Canada. We're able to get there directly for certain reasons, and we're carrying on the defense of ourselves as citizens under our Constitution against this most grave violation of our fundamental rights and freedoms in Canada. So we're here, I'm here still in Quebec City trying to gather evidence, and we want people to who were witnesses to something or they themselves personally saw any form of action of anyone contrary to anyone's right simply to even to be on a street to observe what's going on and to be on a street and let the heads of state know that we don't like what they're doing or and to have a, we have a right to be heard and to be seen. So anybody, whether you saw something, whether you personally had something happen to you, we would like your evidence. If you're prepared to give evidence, that means you either will do it in writing or you'd have to appear and talk about what happened so that we can use that material to stand up for all the rights of Canada. And people have to understand we are not the ones doing something wrong. The state is doing something wrong against us. These police did not even have any legal authority via any order, any law. They were simply handed over the right to make their decision and do what they wanted to provide the security, and that was an illegal process, aside from the fact of all the repercussions that are happening to individuals right now.
In terms of the police being handed over the authority, who handed over that authority?
Well, that's very interesting. That's a very question that we were trying to determine. And what we learned in the Mark Tremblay lawsuit, in the evidence that was filed, the Minister of Trade simply created a body called the Bureau of the Summit, and then that bureau decided that the police, there are three or four levels of police that were going to have the responsibility for security, and those were the RCMP, the city police, the Quebec City Police, and the provincial police, and they created their own little committee without anybody particularly in charge. It's just that there'd be their representatives there, and they basically were given a carte blanche to do what they wanted to do. So in law, I mean, that's not the way we are supposed to function, and that whole process is totally illegal. So that's one of the reasons that we're able to say this is a total violation of what our rights. If indeed there is a gravity in a situation that the government felt needed to have really strong protections, such as a perimeter and such as passes to get in and out, then it was necessary for the government under our law to declare an emergency under the Emergencies Act, the old War Measures Act. They didn't do that. So technically, just in terms of a technical process, they haven't done any of the things that they should have done, if indeed the situation is as grave as it is, which it isn't, of course. They've used a trumped-up idea to protect these heads of state as if they needed this grave protection from the citizens of Canada. And, the reason for them doing that is all political. It's because this is an example of the new regime now that's here, where these heads of state, their officials, are going to run around the world as they've been doing, coming and going as they please, to be totally separated from the masses of humanity, to be able to come and go and do what they want. And what we're seeing here is simply an expression of a new legal entity being created, a new process that's going to protect them and that's going to oppress the masses of people. That is not the law yet in Canada. We still have a formal law which is very different from that. And we as citizens under the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee are using our existing law to say, hold on, you guys, this new world order and this new world regime of law that you're trying to create is not the law here in Canada. And we are simply saying the rule of law in Canada means one law applies to everybody the same, whether it's a prime minister, the minister of trade, or a protester on the street, or a person on welfare. And we're saying apply the law. Apply the law of Canada. That's what we're saying.
Now, is there any kind of specific Canadian law that restricts the amount of force that can be used on Canadian citizens, especially when it comes to chemical weapons?
Well, they can't use that. I mean, this is the whole point, is we've everything's been turned on its head. Like, we are doing something wrong. Somehow we are being made criminals for having the audacity to stand on our streets and be seen and be heard. Everybody has to understand, let's not let them turn it on its head. We have a fundamental right to assemble and to speak. And so people have to understand, never mind the fence, never mind the laissez-passer. The point is, whether or not you say someone should not jump on that fence and shake it or try to break it down, that's not the point. The point is, we have the right to be here. Let's just turn it all back. We have the right to be here, and they did not have the right to take away our entitlements to be on our street, to be seen and to be heard.
And I guess what I was asking is, do they have the right to tear gas us?
No, they don't have the right to tear gas us. That's an act of war. That's an act that you would be able to do in an emergency. If Canada was under siege from something that's going to hurt Canada. See how they've turned it on the head? We, the citizens, are under siege. It's all backwards. So, the fact is, that's why we're able to argue in the law that what they've done is unconstitutional and all turned on its head.
That was Connie Fogel from the Defense of Canadian Liberty Committee speaking with Gretchen King of Syracuse Community Radio. You can contact Connie Fogel and the committee through their website at www.CanadianLiberty.bc.ca CanadianLiberty.bc.ca. To donate to the legal defense of protesters arrested in Quebec City, please visit the Unwelcome Guest website, where we have listed the address where donations can be sent. Meanwhile, back in our allegedly free country, FBI and Secret Service agents visited the Seattle Independent Media Center with a court order, trying to obtain the identity of contributors to the Newswire. The court order included a gag order preventing the IMC from reporting on the government harassment. IMC lawyers challenged the order, and the gag was lifted. Last Friday, the IMC held a press conference.
We take you now live to the press conference.
My name is Devin Terrio Orr, and on behalf of the IMC, I would like to inform the public about the events that have been taking place here over the past week. Standing with me today are David Berman, our legal counsel, Stephanie Benirian, a tech volunteer, Brian Allen, another tech volunteer, and Jonathan Jay, who is the domain registrant for indymedia.org. On the evening of Saturday, April 21st, the Independent Media Center in Seattle was served with a sealed court order by two FBI agents and an agent of the United States Secret Service. The order prevented the Independent Media Center from making any statement. We immediately solicited legal counsel to amend the order. This morning, Federal Magistrate Judge Monica Bitton issued an amended order, freeing us to discuss the situation without the threat of being held in contempt of court. The original order directed the IMC to supply the FBI with all user connection logs for April 20th and 21st from our web server. The order stated that this was part of an ongoing criminal investigation into acts that could constitute violations of Canadian law, specifically theft and mischief. We believe that as a news organization, this order is in violation of our constitutionally protected First Amendment rights. The order also directed the IMC not to disclose the existence of this application or order or the existence of this investigation until or unless authorized by this court. Such a prior restraint on a media organization goes to the heart of the First Amendment. Ironically, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer learned about the existence of the order from federal sources. The Seattle IMC was unable to comment on or correct the inaccuracies in the article due to the gag order. The order did not specify what acts were being investigated. The Secret Service agent acknowledged that the IMC itself was not suspected of criminal activity. The U.S. attorney has also admitted that the underlying acts do not constitute any violations of United States law. Furthermore, it is not clear whether the Constitution allows the U.S. government to seek confidential information from a U.S. media organization in order to facilitate an investigation into alleged violations of Canadian law. Responding to questions from IMC volunteers, the agents claimed that their investigation concerned the source of items which, they said, had been posted to an IMC newswire early Saturday morning. These posts, according to the agents, contained documents purportedly stolen from a Canadian governmental agency including classified information related to the travel itinerary of George W. Bush, who was at that time in Quebec City, participating in the Summit of the Americas meetings. Agents claimed that the Secret Service was notified of the existence of such posts from a tip from an unnamed major commercial news network. IMC volunteers were able to identify the two articles posted to the Montreal IMC, which partially matched the agent's description. However, an in-depth search by IMC volunteers failed to reveal posts on any IMC site with the president's classified travel information. No information regarding these posts were divulged to the federal authorities because the IMC believes that it is constitutionally protected from having to release such information. Although the agents were concerned with only two posts, the court order demands all user connection logs for a 48-hour period. This would include individual IP addresses for every person who posted materials to or visited the IMC site during the huge protest that rocked the Quebec City when the Free Trade Area of the Americas meeting was taking place. During a representative 24-hour period, the IMC received over 750,000 hits. All of these are within the scope of the FBI's court order. We believe that this order is unconstitutionally overbroad because the FBI is only seeking information from two particular contacts, while their court order seeks over 1 million such contacts for the full two-day period. Furthermore, we believe that all information is constitutionally protected. Finally, the overwhelming amount of information demanded by the FBI raises a disturbing question of whether the order is calculated to discourage involvement with the Independent Media Center. Since the incident occurred, several persistent yet false rumors took shape. Some of these found their way into coverage published on Monday's Seattle Post-Intelligencer and other commercial media. We can now dispel some of the more common of these. No search warrant was served on the Seattle IMC in connection with the court order, and nobody connected with the Seattle IMC has been arrested. No equipment or logs have been seized. The agent's visit was not a raid. Now, free from the restrictive court orders, the Seattle IMC will be able to cover this important story as it continues to unfold. Thank you.
That was part of a press conference given by the Seattle Independent Media Center last Friday. So why all this repression on behalf of a trade deal? Here's one Canadian columnist's analysis. This is Just What's in This Trade Deal by Thomas Walcombe, published on Tuesday, April 24th in the Toronto Star. So what was it all about then? In the warm morning sunshine of Toronto, with 6 days' worth of Quebec City laundry still pungent with tear gas roiling through the washing machine, your correspondent from the front lines of the Summit of the Americas tries to sort out a week of curious and often contradictory events. First, to the summit itself. The meeting of the 34 heads of government was called ostensibly to further a free trade area of the Americas. The key document in that proposed pact is a draft text that has still not been made public and which, if the leaders can be believed, was barely discussed in the three-day meeting. To what is Canada binding itself in that proposed pact? What is it proposing to give away that it has not already surrendered in previous trade deals? We do not know. The only portion of the draft text that has been leaked, that dealing with the rights of corporations to override laws and regulations that interfere with potential profits, appears to go further than even the North American Free Trade Agreement. And NAFTA, as the federal government found out when it tried unsuccessfully to ban a gasoline additive on public health grounds, goes quite far. Canada's position? Trade Minister Pierre Pettigrew has said his government doesn't like the section of NAFTA that deals with this kind of thing. He says it gives corporations too much leeway. But on Sunday, Pettigrew's boss, Prime Minister Jean Chrétien, said he thought the so-called investor protection rules in NAFTA have worked well. Whose view will prevail when Canada goes into final talks on the FTAA? My money's on Chrétien. At the official summit itself, much effort was spent convincing reporters that the real achievement of the three-day meeting was to insert a so-called democracy clause into any agreement. Yet the wording of this clause is remarkably weak. binding member governments only to, quote, conduct consultations in the event of a disruption of the democratic system of a country that participates in the summit process, unquote. What will this mean in practice? Suppose a left-wing government determined to curtail the power of U.S. multinational corporations is elected in, say, Chile. Suppose this government is overturned in a military coup. Would the United States really insist that the military withdraw and give back power to the duly elected leftist regime? Washington certainly didn't do so in 1973 when these exact events occurred. Why would we expect it to do so now? Probably the most important theme to emerge from the official summit dealt with energy. As U.S. President George W. Bush put it in his own eloquent way, quote, "We're short of energy. We need more energy," close quote. One indeed suspects that Bush and his team didn't stay up late fretting over most of what appeared in the final communique. Encourage the use of telehealth, promote gender equity and equality, acknowledge the value that the worldview, customs, and traditions of indigenous peoples can make to policies and programs. Rather, Bush, that sly old oil man, was keen on getting as much oil as possible from what he called Canada's tar pits, the tar sands, as well as having Mexico use its resources to generate more electricity for power-hungry California. And Chrétien said he is just as anxious to please. The Prime Minister also said Canada would meet its needs first. Perhaps he forgot that under NAFTA, we can't. Once we turn on the taps to the U.S., we cannot turn them off just because we are running short. Finally, the protesters. Some have written that the violence at Quebec has seriously damaged the cause of those who are opposed to wide-open investment deals such as NAFTA and the proposed FTAA. I'm not so sure. As violent protest goes, Quebec City was relatively tame. The youthful anarchists who did damage property were disciplined enough to attack only institutions most Canadians already mistrust, such as the banks and television networks. Did the violence open up an irreparable split in the anti-globalization movement between those committed to peaceful protest and those insisting on so-called direct action? Listen to what Olga Kolinik, a retired nurse who journeyed to Quebec City to take part in the peaceful protest, had to say. "These young people have shown such courage," she said the day after protesters first breached a section of the fence protecting the summit. "I feel such hope. They are prepared to put their bodies on the line." Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians, one of the groups that sponsored the peaceful protest, concurs. Her organization neither advocates nor condones violence. But she said yesterday, "No one I know thinks they shouldn't have taken on that wall." My guess is that a fair number of Canadians agree. And that was Just What's in This Trade Deal by Thomas Walkham, published in the Toronto Star on Tuesday, April 24th.
On y avance! Excellent! Excellent!
I have a scarf, I have a little bit of vinegar in case the tear gas starts falling, and I want to be part of this moment. I think it's historic too.
You want to be part of this moment? And in terms of the free trade area of America and security, do you think those go hand in hand? Like, you can't have free trade without massive security like this?
I think they go together because people see that the harm that free trade is doing, and they're going to oppose it. More and more people, I think. So this is the true face maybe of trying to implement it.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests with a special report back on the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City.
I'd like to punch Bush in the nose.
You'd like to punch Bush in the nose? You know, he's here. He's out and about somewhere. He's here.
Now they can't get a plane here. You got to come in by helicopter, right?
He's got to come in by helicopter?
Yeah, because they ain't got an airport big enough here for my plane. That's my plane.
That's your
plane? Yeah, they don't understand that. I'm from the United States.
Where are you from?
I'm from Boston, Mass.
Boston, Mass? What brought you out here today?
Well, every time I see my organization, it's the National Action Committee, every time Bush goes somewhere, we'll be there to challenge him. It's nothing but a killer, that's all he is. A serial killer.
So that's Bush all
he
does. Is...
And he killed black people. This is what I'm up here for. And besides, took all the black votes in Miami and threw them in the trash. And that didn't happen only in Miami. It happened all over the United States. In my hometown of Boston, I saw it firsthand where my brother was voting for 25 years. All of a sudden, his name is not on the voting list during this little raggedy election.
Well, part of the requirement for getting into the free trade of area of the Americas is to have a democratically elected leader, and you're saying that Bush is not democratically elected?
This is what you call democracy out here in the street. You can see it. We're out here having a nice time. We're not bombing anybody. We just want to let our voice be heard, you know, around the world, that we don't want this free trade, we don't want that. The companies here going down south, I don't want our tax dollars going down south where they can explore the people down south. You know what I mean?